Sunday night. And I mean from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. John Mack to some. Welcome to the 188th episode of weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to recordings of the previous 107 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. So that's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. As I've said for the last 7.5 months, my last piece for the Western Guardian, the 212th, is still available. That website, www.westernguardian.com. It was hopefully left up there to be read by every living American, and I, of course, hope they do. It's the last of the Creative Disruption series in the paper, as for the September 29th issue last year, the Western Guardian joined the ranks of the New York Herald Tribune, the Washington Star, the New York Journal of America, and the Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. The issue also contained columns by ex-congressperson and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of web articles, of news articles, rather, from around the world and in the country, articles relating to politics, sports, arts and entertainment, books, the environment, and opinion. Try it. It's free. Only one email per day if you subscribe. Then once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. I hope to join us not only tonight and next week when my guest will be Lynn White, New York City television personality and political pundit, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, live or as most of the listeners later. Back to this week's show, the 188th, as I mentioned, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that is 646-716-9756. I normally hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. I'm my guest tonight, and she's told me how to pronounce it three times. Hopefully I'll come close. is Pim Yushuk, a poet, writer, and editor-in-chief of Cutthroat, a Journal of the Arts. Good evening, Pam, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Thank you for calling me today and for asking me on your show.
Let's start right at the beginning. Where'd you grow up, then go to early school?
Where did I grow up? I grew up in Michigan on a farm. My parents moved me to the farm when I was 3 years old. It was an 80-acre working farm. We had Black Angus cattle and ducks and chickens. My father grew corn and wheat and oats, and he named all of his cows like he would name dogs, and they followed him around the farm. He was also an auto worker at the Oldsmobile plant in Lansing, Michigan. So I grew up right in the heart of Michigan. And my mom was a nurse, but she never worked.
Now, you had what for most would be an interesting but challenging childhood, a multilingual family with the history of violent mm-hmm. ancestors, the constantly ill mm-hmm. mother, a number of siblings. In retrospect, mm-hmm. How did it shape you?
Well, actually, I think that the adversity was matched by the love and the passion. I did grow up in an immigrant family. On my father's side, I am Belarus and Mongolian and Czech, and with roots in Azerbaijan and Turkey and Syria, of all places. And so this is a very, very passionate background, and I identified with that family, and we identified ourselves as Russians. On my mom's side, it was a much more American sort of family, very proud of their Anglo roots. They were English and Irish, and we don't know about my grandfather because he was adopted at birth. He was found on a doorstep literally the day he was born, the day after Christmas. So, and my mom was extremely bipolar and had not only psychotic episodes, but she was hospitalized every 2 years, I remember, of my growing up time. So I did not bond with my mother as strongly as I bonded with my father and his family. And all of these things, I think, really shaped my work and led me to believe in social justice. My father was he worked for the union, and he was a union steward, and he actually got the right for black women to use the same bathrooms as white women. So he imbued a sense of justice and honesty in us.
You mentioned in one of the notes to me that you were the oldest, and you really had to take mm-hmm. on at some time the responsibility yeah. of a woman of the house. Was that difficult for a young girl, as you remember?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it was difficult on my siblings, too, because I had to cook for them, and I was a terrible cook. I fed them once spaghetti that was like, it was like cement, because I didn't know enough to throw spaghetti into hot water. I just threw it in cold water and cooked it, and it turned out in a block. And so, yeah, I didn't have many skills with caretaking skills. I had to learn on my own. I did learn a lot from my grandma Anna, who was just 12 miles away. And so she was a great support to me throughout my young life. And thankfully, I had her to model on and her to love me, because my mom and I did not bond. And so that was pretty tough. And, yeah, it was pretty tough having all that responsibility. I still do today. I take responsibility.
Do you remember what your first aspirations were growing up?
Mm-hmm. I absolutely do. First of all, when I was a really young child, I wanted to be an adventurer. I wanted to travel all over the world and be an adventurer. That's how I saw myself, and I saw myself as being a man and not a girl, because I thought that men had much more freedom and could do a lot more cool things than women could. And also, remember, my mom was ill, so I really identified with being a male more than a female until I hit puberty, and then everything flip-flopped. And but as I went to school, first I decided I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to draw. I loved to draw. I loved to paint. I always had a pencil in my hand. I was always drawing something. I tried to draw birds as they were flying. That was pretty challenging for me. And also, I loved to read. I was very good at being a student. And so I knew from the start that I would go to college, because in an immigrant family, at least our immigrant family, that getting an education was very important, and that was drilled into us. Those were some of my ambitions. I also wanted to be Mahatma Gandhi. I thought that would be a good thing to be.
That would have been, except they killed him.
Yeah, I know. Way before I was born.
And then to high school, where'd you go? You went locally?
Yes, I did. I went to DeWitt High School. It was a very small school, and thank God I was put in a gifted program, a gifted writing program, when I was in the ninth grade. And I was also in an accelerated band program, and I played the French horn. And I loved playing the French horn. I thought at one time I would be a musician, but I had to make a choice when I was in the ninth grade whether I would continue with my French horn or be in the gifted writing program. And I chose to be in the gifted writing program.
Your father pushed you academically, too, and it paid off at the mm-hmm. college scholarship. Yet you chose mm-hmm. a lesser-known Michigan University rather than the two more prestigious ones. Why?
I think I was scared. I think I was scared to go to a really big place, and I don't know. You know, looking back on it, of course, I would have had many more advantages had I chose to go to the University of Michigan. I didn't know anybody who went to the University of Michigan. Michigan State University seemed too close to my home, and I really wanted to get away from my home. But I did get that scholarship, the Michigan Higher Educational Scholarship, that funded all 4 years of my college, and I could have gone anywhere. I chose to go to Central Michigan because my cousin went there, and I knew a little bit about it, and it was far enough away that I would be living on campus and not in my home.
What did you study in college?
I studied art. At first, for the first 2 years, I was an art major, actually up until my junior year. And in my junior year, I switched to literature. I loved Russian literature, and I just threw myself into it. I read everything I could get my hands on. Ever since I was a child, I was a voracious reader. And the one thing my mom did give me was a library card. And she would take me to the library often when I was a young girl. And a library card gave me access to the world, and I could be an adventurer by opening a book and escape. I could escape the poverty that we lived in. I could escape my mom's illness. And so that continued in college, too. I just read. I read War and Peace twice as an undergraduate. For instance, I just love books.
Because I was like that, and I still am, thank God. Mm-hmm. After graduation and the graduate mm-hmm. teaching fellowship, you had two short marriages, the second of which that led you to meeting some of the well-known writers and poets of our age, including the multi-talented Kim Harrison. Tell us about Harrison mm-hmm. in particular and those times in general.
Well, after I graduated from college, I decided that I'd spent way too many hours with books, and I wanted to learn something practical, like the names of the birds and the plants. And so I moved to northern Michigan, and I lived in Leelanau County and met Jim Harrison at a bar called Dick's Bar in Lake Leelanau. And I don't know why, we just got along like right away. I just really liked him. He had such a great sense of humor. He was so smart. I read his poetry. I loved his poetry. It spoke to me in a way that other poets hadn't spoken to me. And yes, through him, I met Tom McGuane and other people. And not through him, I met Gary Snyder and Philip Levine and Galway Connell and a bunch of other poets. And Galway Connell was the person who really took an interest in my poetry. And so he was my mentor.
You mentioned that. Although you began your paid life as the teacher, you took the big step after a few years and devoted yourself full time to writing. What caused the move? Mm-hmm. What gave you the confidence to make it?
You know, I've never been afraid of change, John. I think because my early life was so filled with instability because of my mother, but with a great stability because my dad never left her. He was always faithful. He was always there for us. So I had a really strong stability also, and I wasn't afraid to take big steps to change my life, and I seemed to do that. I just did this all the time. You know, after I graduated, I had a full ride fellowship to study Russian literature, and that's when I decided to go live up in the woods. So I jumped off the boat and went and lived in the woods and got to know all these writers. And then when I was 27, I decided to quit my middle school teaching job, and I went to Key West, Florida, and wrote a novel. I went to Key West with my sister Judy, and I wrote a novel in 2 months, and it was 360 page novel. I just decided it was time for me to be a writer, and I thought I gave myself 10 years. If it worked, fine. If it didn't, I'd go find another teaching job.
You finished the novel, and although you've revised it, it had sat dormant for years. Why?
You know, that's a good question. I just had this idea that the first novel was probably pretty bad for most people, and that it's a learning experience, and maybe you should publish your second novel and not your first novel. I talked to Harrison quite a bit about this. He thought I was absolutely balmy, but he also had a good deal of respect for that. He and I used to play marathon games of pool in the bar and just hang out. And so, you know, I think being with those guys who were so ultra successful as writers, also, I really wanted that life. And I thought, well, if he's a poet and he can write prose, I can write prose too. And so I just did that. And, but I didn't want, I was more, I just didn't want to, I didn't want to be commercial. I just wanted to write poetry because it felt to me like that was a pure art form and there was no greed involved and there was not that much ambition involved. So I just wanted to write poetry and publish it.
You then began traveling, reading, in and out of relationships until you received real encouragement, as you mentioned, for poetry from Galway Canal.
Yeah.
Tell us
yes,
about that.
Yes, I did. Well, I was bartending at Interlaken, and that's near Interlaken Arts Academy, and all of these writers would come there and read, and they had a terrific reading series as well as a terrific concert series. And so I went to Galway Canal's reading there with a guy named Mike Maisley, and Mike was also a would-be poet. And we sat with Galway Canal after his reading and just talk. We were highly engaged with one another, and we just talked the entire evening, and he invited us to come for free to Cranbrook, where he was teaching a workshop, and Cranbrook is a very fancy place outside of Detroit. And so we piled in, Mike and I and my sister Judy, piled into my Volkswagen the very next week and went down and took this workshop for free from Canal, and it was fantastic. I had no idea you could take poetry workshops. I didn't know that. You know, it's I so sympathize with writers who don't understand how to become a writer. You know, you write in sort of this vacuum, and even if you know other writers, you don't know the secrets, you know, how you get to do this, this, and the other thing. And so that was a real door opener for me and an eye opener for me. Canal, for some reason, liked my work, and he said, send me whatever you want. And so I did. And he was very lovely. He was lovely with his criticism, and I had a correspondence with him for years. Up until a few years before he died, we had a correspondence.
You were writing, bartending, teaching, running the monthly reading series, and then the long comes William Pitt Root. Who is he?
Who is he? He's my husband today. Yes, I met Bill in Interlaken when, again, I had a lot of friends who were teaching at Interlaken, and some of them were writers themselves. And so when Bill came, I was writing art reviews for the Traverse City Record Eagle and also doing interviews. So I wanted to interview Bill, and I had never read him, actually, and never met him. And then I read one of his poems called Circle of Struggle that was one of the longest poems the New Yorker had ever published, and I was blown away by the sensibility of this man. So I decided, well, I need to interview him. So I called him up for an interview. I had very, very little money from the Michigan Council for the Arts. And unbeknownst to me, he had pumped my friends at Interlaken about me because they told him that I wanted to interview him. And so it was sort of a setup. And so I asked him, you know, would you come and read for my reading series? And he said, well, how much money do you have? And I said, well, I only have $50. And he said, well, that's not enough, but would you like to go to a movie? And that was the start. And I said, sure, I'll go to a movie if I can bring my friends. So I brought 12 friends to that movie. And we, which was sort of overwhelming, but I was literally stricken, almost like lightning. You know how you know that this is the person for you, and that it was true for me. We became friends, And we were friends for a long time before we became lovers. And then I was just sure that he was the one. He was the one. And that's how we started our long adventure together. We're still together today.
Once you and he had established this relationship, you lived all over the country, Oklahoma, Washington, Montana,
mm-hmm.
Arizona, and mm-hmm. finally back to Montana. What kept you on the move?
I think we're both Bill and I are essentially gypsies, or we were. We're pretty stable now. So we loved traveling. He loved traveling as much as I loved traveling and adventuring and meeting people, learning about other cultures. We had various things in common, a sense of social justice and a sense of wanting to give to the greater community, not just being a careerist poet. That didn't interest either he or I. We needed to have our poetry do something that would affect the world in a positive way. We both loved teaching as poets in schools, which we both did. We both taught on Native American nations, and I spent a lot of time, like I think, probably more than about 10 years teaching as a poet in schools, and I learned a lot, you know, from various Native American cultures that I was always interested in. And so, anyway, getting back to it, we just both had that in common, and we loved to travel. We still do.
When you went back to Montana, you then entered Montana's the Master of Fine Arts program, taught poetry for
yes.
schools, and you edited the
yes.
the school's literary magazine, and once again mm-hmm. met many well-known writers. Tell us about that time.
Oh, well, that was very cool because when I went to the University of Montana, well, before I went there, Bill was hired to replace Richard Hugo when Richard Hugo died. And I had met Richard Hugo through Bill a year before that, and a couple of years before that, actually, when Dick came to Port Townsend, where we were living in Port Townsend, Washington, and knocked on the door and said, "I'm looking for Bill Root." And Bill was up in Alaska at that time teaching in Sitka for a few weeks. And I said, "Well, he's not here, but I'm here." So I invited he and his wife in, and we sat around and had coffee and talked. And basically, Dick Hugo always asked for Bill to replace him whenever he went on sabbatical or when he was a visiting writer at various universities. And so when Richard Hugo died, Bill was hired at University of Montana to teach in the MFA program there. And since we moved there and I got a job as a poet in schools, I was very excited to go and work as a poet in schools. And I decided, well, I might as well just get my MFA. Then maybe I can get a teaching job. You know, I was a little sick of being a bartender by then. And it's tough, you know, bartending is fun, but it's also tough. And you have to stay up late at night and work with some pretty violent clientele sometimes. And anyway, that's how I ended up in the MFA program. And I met lots of writers. Jim Welch, the great Blackfeet novelist, James Welch, wrote me a letter of recommendation to get into that program. And then I met Bill Kittredge and I met Jim Crumley. Lots of Montana writers. Richard Ford was a really good friend. Richard would come down to the bar, Pulitzer Prize winning novelist Richard Ford would just come down to the bar and sit and talk to me in the afternoon. And he was like sort of my thug. He and Bill were my thugs. They come down and protect me. And before Richard moved away, he gave me his axe handle to carry around in my car to protect myself. Anyway, I got to meet a lot of really great people. I loved that program. I loved my fellow students in that program. We were all supportive of one another. There wasn't a lot of backbiting at all among the students. And we had ready access to all the writers that came through Missoula, Montana, and they were legion and legendary. I got to study with T.C. Boyle, Dennis Johnson. Let's see, I remember Leslie Marmon Silko came through also, and Tobias Wolff. Some wonderful writers. You know, we're really, really lucky. Donald Hall to study with him.
Sure.
Yeah.
Had Ford already written The Sports Writer by then, or was that still
no,
to come?
No, it was before. Just before he wrote The Sports Writer. He had written a book called A Piece of My Heart.
Right, I remember that, yeah. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and then he wrote
a book of short stories called Rock Springs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the literary magazine that you took over at the school?
Oh, Cut Bank. Cut Bank was, you know, I took it over from John Davis and Greg Glazner, who were the editors before me. And one of the things I'd never, ever worked on a literary magazine before. And so I had a lot to learn, and I had a great staff. Bronwyn Pugh was my constant companion, and she really helped me a lot with that thing, and some fiction writers also. And so we published two issues a year. I had to beg for money in front of the student government every semester, and we had to do it by hand, you know, the old-fashioned way on a lighted table, you know, and figure out leads and all of these printing terms. I had no idea what they were until, you know, I did this magazine. But I instituted then the A.B. Guthrie Fiction Award and the Dick Hugo Poetry Award in honor of those two great Montana writers.
You mentioned bartending. My son is a television writer, and when he graduated from NYU, he did a bunch of things for about a year in New York, and then he was going out to California to chase the muse. So he called me and said, can you get me a job bartending so I have something to fall back on, knowing that I had many contacts that were in the bar business, obviously. So I I did, and it was a weekend bartender in my old neighborhood for one summer, and then went off to California, and thankfully he never had to use it, but he was ready anyhow, so.
Yeah, and there's one other thing I'd like to say about University of Montana, and that is I met a woman who absolutely changed my life. When Joy Harjo came to teach there, I took a workshop from her. I picked her up from the airport, being the editor of Cut Bank. You know, that duty was delegated to me. And Jim Welch said, "Do you know who Joy Harjo is?" And I said, "No, I don't have any idea." He said, "Well, she's something, and you should read her work." And so I did, and I fell in love with her work. She was one of the best teachers I have ever had. She, her classrooms were both a sanctuary and a learning place. She was just so different from anyone else I had ever taken a class from, because she not only taught technique, but she taught on a soul level and on a psychic level that was just astonishing to me.
And she's still your friend.
And she's still my friend, yes. Mm-hmm.
And then you went off to New York, and here our paths almost crossed. Tell us about going to New York. Tell us about going to New York.
Okay. In 1986, when I graduated from the University of Montana, Bill got a teaching job at Hunter College in Manhattan. So we schlepped everything over, packed the dogs up, packed all of our stuff up, and moved to New York. And we decided to live in a small community called New Paltz, which is a beautiful little town across the Hudson River from Poughkeepsie. And Bill was going to then commute from this lovely place upriver from New York to Manhattan, and which he did. It was a hell of a commute. It was, you know, sometimes it was 3 or 4 hours one way. He took the train from Poughkeepsie. He took the bus from New Paltz sometimes, but Yeah, so we were thrown into a very different life there in New York, and I looked for a job and got a job at Marist College, which is in Poughkeepsie, New York, and volunteered to teach in their prison program. So I taught for 6 years in a maximum security for men in upstate New York. Again, jumping into something totally different because I wanted the experience, and I thought I could make a difference in the prison. And it was a regular undergraduate program from Marist that I taught in. We offered 4 degrees, and they cut the recidivism rate by 65%. And so we were really proud of that program.
I was at Marist at that time. I was an adjunct.
Wow.
And I was also a consultant to a Dennis Murray, who was the president of the college, and I,
wow.
And I knew Eileen Bull, who ran the prison programs then, and that,
mm-hmm.
and Dennis asked me to do some consulting to a, there was, the fellow in Greenhaven, who had killed his wife and her lover, and he was in for life, and he wouldn't have had life mm-hmm. if it was a crime of passion, but when he found where they were, he went home and he got the knife, and then he went into them. So the first day that I parked my Volkswagen at Greenhaven, which as mm-hmm. you remember, had a 30-foot wall and 30 feet into the ground. It was originally built
underground.
It was originally built for prisoners during World War II. I parked my Volkswagen, and I hear this voice all of a sudden. You have to move that car. I thought it was from God. It was a voice from the walls of the prison. So then it was a little scary in that, as you know, they don't open the next door in front of you until they close the one behind you, and you start to think,
exactly.
What if they forget? Mm-hmm. What if they forget I'm here? But but I remember
it was spooky.
I remember walking down the hall with the woman who was the in-house Marist person, and as mm-hmm. we're walking along, there's all these fairly hard cases. They're licking their lips and they're how do you handle
that calling all
yeah.
the way down? Yep.
Mm-hmm. I said, how do you handle this? And she said, well, they get used to it. Now at that time, it was, by the way, it's a little different from some of the note that you mentioned about your memory in that, the guards liked it because one of the things they could do if people weren't behaving, they could have them taken out of the program, or they could have them transferred way up by the Canadian border, you know, out of here. So it was the benefit. And when they eventually killed the program because of
funding, I couldn't believe when they killed the program. The Pell Grants were gone. Yeah.
I'll never forget the some congressman from Kentucky standing up and saying, you know, there's people in my district, hardworking men who make $12,300, and they can't send their kids to school, but these murderers and rapists get an education. It was a complete snow job, because when they killed the program, the money didn't go to the hardworking guys making $12,000. It just went away, you know.
Right.
And if you talk to the guards, they thought they had lost something. You know, they had this hammer that if you screw up, that they were going to take away their benefits. Now Dutchess County was able to continue their 2-year program, the undergraduate program, but Marist had to drop theirs. And I asked Dennis, I said, what happens when they graduate? He said, you know, where to go on to? He said, well, he said, they don't tend to join the alumni program. So I said, oh, okay. So But
I was heartbroken when they killed that program.
Were you still there when
they killed that program? Well, they killed that program the year that I left.
Okay.
I left at the end of 1992 because my husband had sabbatical for 1993. So we went to Colorado, where we had just bought a home in Durango, Colorado, because my family moved to Colorado in 1985. My parents did, at least my sister had been living there for a long time. Anyway, so I missed the end of that, but yeah, it was sad because I think that program was very effective. I don't think I would have taught any longer in it, though, John, because as good of a program as it was also soul eroding for me to go into that prison with its with the catcalls and the violence and the sheer desperation of people around you. You know, I loved my students. They protected me. They were actually much more protective than the guards. I thought, but there were some bad things that happened. Like one night during the classes, the librarian was raped.
Oh, wow.
And there was some bad stuff that happened.
They,
and it didn't.
You wouldn't recognize.
And there were very few women were teaching in that program, if you remember.
Right.
I think the first night I went in there was just me and a woman from Puerto Rico, and she looked at me and she said, "Have you ever done this before?" And I said, "No, I have taught in a women's prison before." And she said, "Well, I have one piece of advice, don't ever let them know you're scared." And it was a very good piece of advice.
You wouldn't recognize Maris. Maris, as you probably know, is beautiful. It's right on the Hudson River.
Yes.
And these, well,
it's gorgeous. Yeah.
Well, the buildings there now, when the library went up, it was the nicest library in the country. Not because of the books or anything, just because of what they did with it. And there were places very early in the game where students could plug their own laptops in. If they didn't have one, they could check one out to write. You know, the buildings.
So beautiful.
Dennis Murray was the president there for over 40 years. I still have a connection there. I volunteer in something called the Center for Lifetime Studies that I teach. I teach seniors who take all these interesting courses. They take geology of the Hudson Valley, and I teach technology kind of things, and it's giving something back. And then you went back. Then you went back west, and you began to be published in all the well-known poetry journals, and then a full-length book of poems. Tell us about the breakthrough.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I was lucky. All along, I kept being published by really good places. In fact, at University of Montana, when I was an undergraduate, I mean, as a graduate student, I published 3 poems in Poetry Magazine, which is very difficult, you know, to do. And so I was being published in some pretty good places anyway. When I went to New York, it just sort of, it grew exponentially. But I had a hard time getting a book out. I was sending to contests, and I was twice a finalist in the Yale Younger contest. I was a finalist in all these contests. The Walt Whitman Prize for all of the Houghton Mifflin had a young poet series at that time. I came in second. I couldn't believe it. You know, it was like, wow, why am I coming in second? So I was a bridesmaid for a long time. And then when we moved back west, of course, I had different friends. We moved down to Tucson, where Bill could commute from Tucson to his job at Hunter College, which was a fabulous job, I have to say. Hunter College is an amazing place. And Bill's classes were like walking into the UN. He had students from all over the world, and it was the most radical college of the CUNY system. So a very, very interesting place to be. So Bill kept his job there. And I worked on Native American reservations here in the Southwest. I worked with the Tohono O'odham people and with the Yaqui people, and became a director of a program called Arts Reach. And I worked with all 19 districts of the Tohono O'odham people. And so it was really, you know, a rich time. And I wrote like crazy here. Met a friend named Luis Alberto Rea. And Luis, this was before Luis had written or published any books. So Luis and I became really good buds. And he went to Texas after his first book came out. And he came back and he said, Pam, I've got a place you should send a book to, really. It's called Wings Press. It's in San Antonio, Texas. I think you need to send your book there. So I did, and that's how I got the breakthrough. The publisher's name, Bryce Milligan, turns out to be just a terrific publisher. I love him. It's the oldest small press in Texas, and he has a ton of authors, hundreds of authors. He reprinted Black Like Me. He publishes novels and nonfiction, anthologies, as well as poetry. And he used to publish children's books. But anyway, I was really lucky that Luis suggested that, because it's been a very happy marriage with me and Wings Press. And had I not been, picked up by Wings Press, I wouldn't have won the American Book Award. Bryce, he just has so much faith in me. And so he published Crazy Love in 2010, and that one won the American Book Award. So been really, really lucky, I think, to be with this wonderful small press.
That's a terrific story. I was very different. I was an English major in college, and when I graduated, I through luck became a technologist. Even though I had known nothing about computers, had no interest about computers, something just took me there. And not only didn't I write any poetry, I never read a poem for years. And then I was walking through my local Barnes & Noble, where I tend to hang out, and I happened to see the title of the book by Charles Bukowski. And I said, oh, that's an interesting title. So I picked up the book, and I started through the book, and I said, this guy's crazy, but I could do this.
Yeah, he is.
And then I happened to see in the Modem Cycle magazine, the quote about being at an age where the mind writes checks that the body can't cash. Then I said, that's a great line. And I wrote this this poem,
Cash. This is a great line.
and I wound up, for some reason, a friend of mine liked it. So I sent it to some contest I never heard of. And then about 6 months later, another friend called to congratulate me that I'd won fourth prize in his poetry and writers contest. And I said, "Oh, I forgot about that." And it was a lot. It was $25 and a subscription to the magazine, you know. but that got me compulsive. Up until then, all of my writing had been nonfiction, and it had to do with either technology or the world around us, or politics. So it's interesting how something just set you off. I wrote an anti Donald Trump poem in 2009, before most people in the world
well,
ever heard it.
You're right. You're way ahead of your time.
And then poetry took you all over, and to the home of your ancestors.
It has taken me all over.
To the home of your ancestors,
it did.
To Prague.
I was so lucky to. Well, this is a long story too, but just to make it a little bit shorter, we were invited to read at the Struga Poetry Festival by people in Macedonia, and one of the people was a journalist husband of one of Bill's students who had us over there, and they loved both of our poetry, and so and Bill was still teaching at Hunter College then, and I was here you know, down in the desert. And we were invited, and I don't know how we got invited, but we got invited to this fantastic poetry festival. The State Department paid for our trip, and the ambassador came and met us when we landed, you know, in Macedonia. So anyway, it was lovely. I happened to win the Struga Poetry Prize. They offered a prize for the best single poem, and there were 165 poets from various countries in Europe and Asia who were at the conference who also submitted poems. So I was like, wow, that was incredible. I won a 20-year-old keg of 20-year-old brandy, and besides being translated into Macedonian. So I've also been very lucky, I think, because that led then to teaching in Prague. And I taught in Prague for 6 years, for six different summers. And I love that program, the Prague Summer Program. I've taken students there. I've taught with some wonderful people, met Richard Jackson in Macedonia. And then, you know, he introduced us to Richard Kotrovas, who was married to a Czech. And, of course, I'm part Czech. And so we got invited over to Prague. And, yeah, it's been a good association. I think we still sit, Bill and I both are board members of the Prague Summer Program.
You mentioned that it's taking you all over the U.S. and to much of the world, but it's also allowed you to strengthen a connection with Buddhism. Tell us about that aspect of your life.
Oh, yeah. Boy, that is a very strong connection, too. In 2007, I was hired at Fort Lewis College in Durango, Colorado, and they are the only one of the few places in the nation where Native American students can go without paying tuition. So there are 165 tribes represented in the student body. Another teacher and I decided we wanted to take students to Tibet or to study Tibetan Buddhism. So we couldn't take them to Tibet, but we could take them to Ladakh, which is called Little Tibet, and that is north in northern India. And then we wanted to take them to see the Dalai Lama. So I began my more serious studies into Buddhism. I had always been interested. Actually, since I was in high school, I read the Upanishads in high school, and so I was always interested in this thing called Buddhism. And I thought, well, this will just cement it. And so we took 8 students from Fort Lewis to India and spent a month there, where we lived solely with the Tibetan refugee communities. And we were in Ladakh for about 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, climbing around in the high Himalayas. We backpacked into a village called Mangyu Village. We went to many monasteries, learned a whole lot about Tibetan sutras and Tibetan poetry and their song tradition. The students wrote every day. I wrote every day. I carry a journal with me no matter where I go. I don't know what I'm going to do with all these journals. I've been a journaler all my life. But anyway, then we went for 2 weeks to Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama is, and we were lucky enough to be there at the exact same time. He was interpreting sutras for monks who'd walked across the Himalayas from all parts of Southeast Asia. And so we were there for 2 weeks, and we got to see him maybe 2 or 3 times. And, oh, my God, the man is like a walking golden aura of grace and kindness. And again, we learned more and more about the Tibetan culture and about Tibetan Buddhism. We met Tibetan authors, Muslim authors, all kinds of writers in India. The experiences there were life-changing, absolutely life-changing for all of us. I got very sick there, almost died, but I did recover. And so, you know, that has stayed with me and really helped me when I, in 2012, was diagnosed with cancer. So I came back, you know, that was the story of going to Tibet. And we went to see the Dalai Lama's doctors. We went to the hospital. I went to the Dalai Lama's astrologer. It was really very, very interesting. You know, the whole trip was interesting. And it was like food, you know, that I keep digesting and I will throughout my life.
To take you back to New York, Cold Spring, which is south of Poughkeepsie, but it's not too far from Greenhaven. Route 303 mm-hmm. comes out of Cold Spring, then goes east. Mm-hmm. And sitting mm-hmm. on that in the town of Kent is mm-hmm. is a Buddhist temple. And when the mm-hmm. Dalai Lama is mm-hmm. in the area, he stays there. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
years ago, my wife and son went up to see him. There was a whole lot of people. They fed all the people, like the loads and the fishes.
Mm-hmm.
They gave out box mm-hmm. lunches to all the visitors.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and you know, and it's so easy now to get down when you look at some of the leadership that we see, both in the United States mm-hmm. and possibly in France. But then you mm-hmm. look. And you see in the world that we have the Dalai Lama, we have Pope Francis, mm-hmm. and that gives us
yeah.
some hope.
Yeah.
That gives us some hope, I think.
We have some great religious leaders right now. Yes, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. They are the balance. You know, I do believe that we have balances in the universe, and I believe in a very highly layered universe with many dimensions, a multidimensional universe. And these provide solace in these times when it seems that tyranny has taken over our country, and you just witness atrocities every day when it comes to these edicts that are coming out of the White House. They're pretty scary anti-humanitarian edicts in favor of large corporations and against the environment and against human beings and against immigrant peoples, against people of color. It's the Dalai Lama's, yeah, definitely a balance against that. And Pope Francis, too. I admire them both.
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about what comes out of the White House is that there are constant changes. I never said that. I never did this, you know. It will be a health insurance. It'll be cheaper for everyone, and no one will lose their benefits. Oh, I didn't say that, you know. And just it's and we buy
the
this.
Lies.
Yeah.
Lies are amazing. They remind me very much. I wrote my a graduate thesis on Solzhenitsyn and his work.
Right.
And Solzhenitsyn was the great he was a great opener of truth in Russia, because he's writing about a society that's built on lies, and it reminds me so much in the Soviet Union what's happening in our government right now. The lies that come out every day totally befuddle the American people, one lie after the other, and coming in great succession. It just, you know, keep people, you know, you taught in prison, you were in prison. It keeps people off balance, you know, and that's the way you control people. If you keep them off balance and unstable, you can control them.
And if you saw that rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania yesterday, he still has the rabid fans who believe everything he says. And today he published an editorial piece in the Washington Post, put in my newsletter, and it said that he's kept all his promises to the American public. He hasn't kept any. However,
no,
he writes this and they believe it.
No,
over recent years,
spoken mirror show.
Yeah. Over recent years, you got through the loss of siblings and your own cancer and carried on to found Cutthroat, a journal for the arts, now in its 11th mm-hmm. or 12th year with the mm-hmm. 10-year anthology, The Best of Cutthroat, 10 years of print edition available on Amazon. Tell us about this stage mm-hmm. of your life.
Oh, Cutthroat is such a marvelous thing. I now devote a lot of time to Cutthroat. Since the election, we have published a large anthology of American writers called Truth to Power, Writers Respond to the Rhetoric of Hate and Fear. We have some of the biggest writers in our country in this, including Wendell Berry, Carolyn Forché, Martina Spada, Rita Dove, Xiangyang Feng, Ann Fisher Wirth, Annie Finch, Joy Harjo, Linda Hogan. Gee, there's just like a ton of these. Patricia Smith and Melissa Studdard, Pritchard, Marilyn Callett, Patricia Spears Jones, who just won the Jackson Prize for $50,000, Pam Houston, Garrett Hongo. Just incredibly big names in this this anthology, because people are so, I don't know, writers needed a venue. They needed a way to speak about what's happening in our country. And so this is the response to the rhetoric that was stirred up during the election, during the campaigns for the election, and the xenophobia, the rise of xenophobia again, and racism on a huge scale, the rise of anti-immigrant sentiment, the rise against the natural world. You know, it's just crazy where we're headed now. The people who deny there's climate change and the scientific proof is right in front of their noses. We're talking about the survival of our planet. You know, this is the place we live. This we need clean air. We need clean water. We need not to hate people. And the hate that's been unleashed between people by this election is just overwhelming. So Cutthroat, which my husband and I started in 2007, we started that in 2005, actually. Really is the venue for us to keep literature alive in America and also to speak out against this horrible wave of hate and oppression.
I also mentioned that you had gotten through the loss of siblings and your own cancer. Mm-hmm. How were you able to get all this going as you were getting through these personal traumas?
Yeah, it was pretty tough. I lost my brother John in 2010, and he died of esophageal cancer way too young. And he was a Vietnam veteran. He was in the very last year of the war, the Vietnam War, and he was sprayed repeatedly with Agent Orange. He and his friend Jim Slate went in together, and my brother got esophageal cancer, and he was dead within a year. It was horrible, horrifying thing. And Jim Slate died of the same thing a couple of years later. Even the military admits that Agent Orange was a huge debacle and a huge contributor to cancer among the soldiers who fought in Vietnam. So that was very tough for me to get through. He was my only brother. We were only 18 months apart, so that threw me into, you know, some real grief. And then in 2011, I got a great gift from University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and Marilyn Callett, who was instrumental in bringing me there, and I was named the John C. Hodges Chair there for you know, as visiting writer, and it was a great, wonderful time. And Bill then was named the John C. Hodges Chair right after me. And so we were in Knoxville, this beautiful flagship university, for a year. And then I came back to Colorado, and within 6 months, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And because I was misdiagnosed in Colorado, for at least 2 months, my cancer became quite advanced. And so I, when I was diagnosed, I told the person who did that that I needed to be recommended or referred to the Mayo Clinic, and I was, and the fates were with me. I had so much support from people on Facebook that I didn't even know. from people who read my poems in various parts of the country, all over the world. Healers came forth to help me, and I mean traditional healers like medicine people and curanderas from Chicano culture. Just all kinds of prayer groups formed in different parts of the country. Just people I'd worked with, and I had the best, one of the foremost ovarian cancer specialist at the Mayo Clinic, and his name is Javier Magrina. Dr. Magrina did the surgery, and then I had 5 months of grueling, grueling chemotherapy. It was intense, and a lot of people don't even survive this kind of chemotherapy, but I made it through, and it was rugged, it was rough. It took me another, at least 2 years after I finished the chemotherapy before I got my energy back. And I've, you know, it really changed my life and my writing. I worked on a book when I finished chemotherapy. The day I finished chemotherapy, I started writing a book called The Book of Healers Healing. And it's a narrative of my journey, the poems that I wrote while I was in chemotherapy, because sometimes if I could get one line out, that would be my day's triumph as I was laying on the couch really, really, really sick. You know, so many things. I had so many bad side effects from the chemo that, and I don't want to, you know, list them all now. But anyway, that book, The Book of Healers Healing, I decided to interview all of my the healers who helped me. And so the book is 420-some pages long, and it's at an agent right now. I don't know if it's ever going to be finished. I keep adding to it because healing is a lifelong process. And so, yeah, that's how I got through. And then I lost my sister Judy about a year and a half ago, and that was really dreadful too because she was very important to me. So, yeah, I have had a lot of challenges.
Do mention the University of Tennessee. I have a friend who was the chair of medieval studies there for years, and he, and at one time, the University of Tennessee added to the football stadium, and. For about a year, it was the biggest in the country. Then the University of Michigan added some more to the big house, and once again became the largest. And I know they had all this revenue and all this real football school. So I asked my friend, I said, "How does the faculty handle this? Do they resent all this focus on football?" And he said, "Are you crazy? There wouldn't be the chair of medieval studies if it weren't for football." So I thought, okay, I get it.
Oh, no, it was great. I mean, they funded me coming. You know, they funded Bill coming. I love the University of Tennessee, and now they have an MFA program. And I have to say that those people who teach creative writing there are just the one most wonderful faculty I've ever worked with. There's no backbiting. There's no animosity. Totally different from where I was working at teaching in Fort Lewis College, which was the snake pit often of animosity and division. And the administration was very secretive and lying to the faculty. And I quit my job there at the end of 2015. I could no longer work at a university where the administration literally decided to add another class to the teaching schedule without giving the teachers a pay raise. And even though I wasn't affected by that, I couldn't stand what was going on there. The lies of the administration behind the faculty's backs were just, it was overwhelming. And they were instituting standardized syllabuses, and you can't teach from a standardized syllabus. You can't teach poetry from a standardized syllabus and have any kind of creative teaching experience. I love teaching, and I wouldn't do that. I taught environmental literature and poetry there for almost 8 years, and I just couldn't stand what was going on there. But University of Tennessee was great.
Yeah, I teach college, and the important thing that I bring to the table is my experience both in the professional world and in the writing world, and then have a standardized course with someone else who may be very effective but has a different skill to bring to the table. Just doesn't make sense to me.
No,
I know,
not for creative writing.
I know.
No.
You're back teaching and you're writing. What else is next for you?
Well, what else is next for me? I'm going to get this book, The Healer's Healing, out. So I'm going to put it through another revision and maybe change the structure a little bit. So I'm working on that. I have those novels that are put away. I have two novels that are finished, and they are both over 300 pages long. I'm going to get those out finally and take a look at those again. Just this past month was writing, because it's National Poetry Month, was writing not only a poem a day, but sometimes two poems a day. So I have actually a new book of poems that is going to be ready quite soon for me to send on the wings. And so that's all going on. I teach at University of Arizona Poetry Center once a year. I really love doing that. I'm going to be hiking, hiking with my dog, enjoying my husband, enjoying our family. Lots of things going on.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about you?
Well, how about if I read you a poem?
I'd love it.
Would you, like, I've got so many, you know, because I have six books of poems out here in the U.S., and then I have a book of poems that came out in New Delhi in India, which was really another story in itself, but a really cool story. But let me see. Let me read you Finding Peaches in the Desert, because this poem is probably one of my most translated poems. And it seems to hold up well throughout the time. It's been translated into several languages. And this book actually has two, Korean and Albanian and Russian and all kinds of languages. Finding Peaches in the Desert. They taste like a woman, you say, and bite deep into the sweet heat, squeezing through tender skin. While I laugh, taking the fruit you offer, we close our eyes and transport this delicious host to our loves flown distant as time in dreams. You can never eat too many, I say, and pull another ripe peach from the desert tree. It fills my palm, my mouth, as I suck the unhusbanded nectar. It is as delicious as stealing light, such innocent grace, a holiday from history and eternity. We bare our breasts to sun, as women have done for centuries, beside the blue water pool, at ease with rabbits, shrill wasps, the shy steps of occasional deer, while vultures funnel mid-heaven. Struck dumb by sun, cauterizing the Sonoran sky that flings its blue skirt all the way across the ripe hip of Mexico, we feast on peach after peach, while peach-colored tanagers, wet green hummingbirds, and the topaz eyes of lizards attend our anointment. When I wipe one quarter across my breast and down my stomach to my thighs, I am amazed at the baked odor of love rising from everything I touch. This is our ceremony to alter the news of troops that mass for attack in the Middle East, to alchemize all hatred and greed, whatever name it is given by multinational interests. There is no aggression in sharing rare fruit, priceless as the wide imaginings of sky or the brilliant coinage of dragonfly wings. Even squadrons of wasps and fire ants armed with nuclear stingers turn from attack to the pungency of this ritual feast that celebrates love in the desert stunned green by unusual rain.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank
the,
you.
If you'll send me that, I will put it out when I write the article about the talk.
Okay.
I'll include that. So I'll do that. Thank you very much, Pam. It's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been a pleasure talking to you, John. It's been wonderful. You've taken me back to New York. I miss it there.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon. I've blogged at medium.com and published the daily paper mentioned above. Send any comments or questions to me about the show. johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words, the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in the book. Go to my website, and I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with WNBC TV's Lynn White, then every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And on the last day of April, I'll ask Count Basie to take us up. Thanks again, Pam.
Thank you, John. It was just a pleasure.
So good night, everybody.
Okay, good night.